You're listening to Feminist Frequencies. Last week, we talked about a journalist who became a broadcaster, Mary Margaret McBride, with her over 30,000 interviews over the course of her career. This episode is going to be just a little bit different. See, this episode isn't about one woman. It's about many women who came to be something of a novelty in 1955, Memphis, Tennessee. You'll notice that the title of this episode is something different, and there are multiple reasons for that. The first of which is because this episode is something different from all of the other episodes that have been and will be a part of this series. The other reason is because it was part of a motto from a man named Sam Phillips. A former engineer of a studio that he founded even said that it was a part of his personal motto. His personal motto was that if you're not doing something different, you're not doing anything at all. You might recognize the name of Sam Phillips, especially if you recognize the names Elvis Presley or Johnny Cash. See, Sam Phillips was the one who discovered these men. Sam Phillips was actually from Alabama, but he ended up moving to Tennessee later on in his life, and then began working with radio stations, and then founded a recording studio. This recording studio would be called Sun Records. Part of the reason that his motto was that if you're not doing something different, you're not doing anything at all, is because he would get creative, both when he worked in radio and when he was working in his studio. Part of his job when he was working at a radio station was to go and pre-record music, like live music, to then be played on the air later on. And instead of doing the same thing that anybody else would do in recording these performances, he would position the mics differently to be able to pick up different sounds, like the sounds of the bass or the sounds of the brass. He even brought this with him when he started his recording studio and would get creative with the speakers in the amps if they weren't working properly or if he wanted the sound to sound different. He would stuff newspapers inside of them or cover them with cardboard boxes according to Popular Mechanics. It was while running this studio that he would meet an 18-year-old Elvis Presley who would come in and record two songs as a birthday present for his mother. Sam Phillips wasn't even in the studio when it happened. It was actually his secretary who took down his information and had Sam call him back. This secretary was Marion Kiesker, and she'll become important later on in this story too. Sam Phillips helped to launch the careers of other musicians as well, but I emphasize Elvis as one of the most important because Elvis would go on to work with RCA Records. Sam Phillips sold his contract to RCA Records. And a part of the reason that he sold that contract was to get the money to be able to fund a radio station, specifically an all-women's radio station. But he still needed some help. This was when he reached out to a man named Clemens Wilson. Clemens Wilson was a millionaire in the 1950s in Memphis, Tennessee, because he founded the Holiday Inn. Now, there weren't very many locations of the Holiday Inn at this time, but he was still on board with Sam Phillips's proposal and even offered to house the girls in the third ever location of the Holiday Inn in Memphis, Tennessee. This is how the Holiday Inn became the first ever location of WHER in its early days, and they wouldn't move out of the Holiday Inn until 1965, when they moved to the Mid-City building. I also believe that it's important to mention that WHER, as well as another station that I'll highlight later on in this episode, were not gimmicks from Sam Phillips. He genuinely believed in the mission of the station and in the power of the women's voices behind the stations. He believed that they could become something great as a part of this station, and if given the resources and the platforms and the microphones to be able to use their voices on air effectively, they would be able to do it. And do it, they did. In the early days of WHER, none of the women knew that it was going to be an all-girls station. In fact, all of the women who were interviewed for their positions thought that they were going to be the only girl working in the station, because that would have been the more typical thing that would have happened. There wouldn't have been very many women in the studios, so all of them thought that they were the only one. It wasn't until they were on air for the very first time that they knew that it was an all-girls station. And this was somewhat by design. The girls that were hired were all kinds of women. There were women who were single, women who were married. There were women who were separated. Some of them had kids and some of them didn't. They didn't even need experience in broadcast. There were women who were actresses or telephone operators that were hired. There were also models and beauty queens. It genuinely did not matter that they didn't have the radio experience. They were still able to be on air in the early days of this station and throughout its 17-year run. The first station manager was a woman named Dottie Abbott. All of the hiring went through her, as well as Sam Phillips. The music went through Sam Phillips's wife, Becky. She would judge the music for its tempo, for its language, and more before it could even be played on the air. There were high standards because there couldn't be any foul language, it couldn't be too fast, it couldn't be rock and roll. So she would write notes next to all of the songs and would have a tempo guide of sorts for the women who were playing the music on the air so that they would know what to play and when to play it. Did you know that there was an all-girls station in 1955 in Memphis, Tennessee? Keep listening for more about WHER here on Feminist Frequencies. And you heard that right. It is WHER. When you think about all women running a radio station in the 1950s, you might think of a certain set of content, and to an extent, you might be right. There were kitchen segments and home advice segments, beauty advice. There was no cursing, and there was no rock and roll either. This might seem a little bit ironic when you realize that the station was funded by Sam Phillips, who had a massive impact on the scene of rock and roll at the time, but this was by design. They played jazz music or country music, things that were softer and smoother than rock and roll, because that wouldn't have been so abrasive. In order for an all-girls station to get popular in the 1950s, they had to be careful with those sorts of things, leading to the kinds of content that they would put out. That being said, that didn't mean the station wasn't fun. All of the rooms had names. For example, the station manager, Dottie Abbott's office, had a name. It was called the Boss Ma'am's office. There was also the control room, which would have been the playroom, and the studio, which would have been the doll den. The doll den was even said to have been decorated like a dollhouse, according to an NPR piece on WHER. The walls were painted pink and purple and other light colors. They had bras and pantyhose tacked up on all of the walls around them. There were lipstick and mirrors everywhere to contribute to this air of femininity throughout the station. It was not just blank walls. They had fun with it despite the amount of professionalism they were putting out with this station. Every role in WHER was held by a woman for almost 15 years. Every single position, executives, broadcasters, sales staff, all of them were women. Dottie Abbott was the first general manager, and she even said that they weren't really trying to prove anything, but that women could organize and do exactly what they decided to do. She would also host a music show, and on that show, she was known as Dottie Holiday. The Holiday, of course, came from the Holiday Inn where the station was originally housed. The first woman ever heard over the station was Marion Kiesker. If you remember, Marion Kiesker was Sam Phillips' secretary over at Sun Records and was the one to essentially discover Elvis even before Sam Phillips had. She would go on to be a part of the staff at the station as well. The sales department, again, all women, really worked to sell the station. Honestly, it was easy to sell, considering they were all women, but they also had news at the top of the hour, which would have been a much easier sell to advertisers. Then there were the disc jockeys, otherwise known as the jockettes. Of course, there were the music shows, the beauty segments, the kitchen, the life advice, those sorts of segments that you would typically expect, but that doesn't mean that that's all that there was. They even had sports reporters, a pioneer for which being a woman named Peggy Sternberger, who was well known for being a women's golfer. They also had talk radio, which was not very popular at the time either, but they held an open mic segment later on in the station's tenure. The show was called Open Mic, and that's mic spelled M-I-K-E, and was hosted by a woman named Marge Thrasher. It was a call-in show, and there was a 7-second delay on it just in case they had to take out any unsavory content, because again, this was a part of their professionalism. But there was a massive audience for this show. There was such a massive audience, in fact, that when it was announced that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated, this was the show that they made the announcement on. In fact, she was on the air when another woman in the station watched this news being typed out and took the paper to her to read it. She then read it out over the air, played a song, and started taking calls. Ms. Thrasher ended up walking out of the studio shortly after because the first call-in was incredibly rude and offensive, and she didn't know what to do. So she hung up the phone, sat in silence for a moment, and got up and walked out. The station manager at the time was also shocked about this. After that, the station even introduced a more structured news segment so that it wouldn't just be people calling in and venting their frustrations about whatever was going on in the world at the time. This would have been in the 1960s at this point, where the civil rights movement and the women's liberation movements would have been starting to gain some footing, as well as any wars that were happening in the time period that people were frustrated about. So this new structure to their news segments helped them present that air of professionalism just a little bit further so that they could prevent these issues from happening ever again. So what happened to WHER? Unfortunately, the station was not able to last despite its popularity in the time. They hired their first male manager in the late 50s and early 60s. This was a man named Charlie Sullivan. When the girls were even asked about why they didn't hire another woman, they basically said that there weren't many women who were like their former manager, Dottie Abbott. In those first 15 years, there were only really two men in the station, one of whom being Charlie Sullivan. Then in the 1970s, WHER became WWEE. They repainted the walls from the pink color that they were, they started employing more men, and they just were not this all-women station anymore. That being said, it wasn't like the station wasn't important or popular in its own way, and it has now become an incredibly fascinating and kind of beautiful piece of history for women in broadcast. In the station's 17-year run as WHER, it had quite an impact on women in broadcast and across the world. The station was inspiring for women. It gave women jobs, even if the pay wasn't absolutely fantastic, and it created a professional environment and a professional face for women in the broadcast industry. WHER also wasn't the only station of its kind. Sam Phillips founded another all-girls station in Palm Beach, Florida in 1959. Inspired by the idea of WHER, WLIZ was in Palm Beach, Florida, and according to the Palm Beach Post, the station was named for Elizabeth Taylor and was marketed as an all-girl station, similarly to how WHER was. The station wouldn't last and was actually renamed WLVS in honor of Elvis in the 1980s and would become a religious station, but that didn't mean that it wasn't important in its own way as well. See, some important women who are a part of WLIZ were Deirdre Hall of Days of Our Lives, as well as Rhonda Glenn, who was another golfer and the first full-time female broadcaster for ESPN. Coming back to WHER, Jaclyn Hall said in an NPR article that WHER was part of the early days of the Women's Liberation Movement, although the Women's Liberation Movement wouldn't have actually occurred until the 1970s. Those roots had to come from somewhere. Part of that somewhere would have been WHER, since it took place in the 1950s in Memphis, Tennessee, and gave women an influential platform at the same time as the civil rights movement. This would have been another way that WHER had an impact, because Sam Phillips was very aware of their position in the 1950s and part of the racial boundary that they had an opportunity to overcome as a part of the station and in his own professional life through music as well. While again, this station would not last, it has clearly had an impact on the broadcast industry, on women in broadcast, and how they have continued to be able to make careers out of broadcasting in sales and executive positions in the radio industry today. Next week on Feminist Frequencies, we'll be back to somewhat talking about WHER by way of Becky Phillips herself. By going back to the standard format of talking about one woman, we get to dive more into one of the individual lives of one of the women at WHER, specifically the wife of Sam Phillips, who was the one to fund and found the station. More on Becky Phillips and some more in-depth on WHER next week on Feminist Frequencies. This is Maggie Berner, signing off.